You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio, 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, December 13, 2017.
And to treat this as a public health issue and not a criminal justice issue. Unfortunately, we have remnants within the criminal justice system who refuse to let go.
Coming up later in the program, Monroe County reapproved a syringe exchange program this week. WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with Indiana Recovery Alliance founder and director Chris Abert about the syringe support program on today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, everything you need to know about holiday scams and swindles. Coming up on a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
People living with HIV in South Central Indiana now have a primary care service through IU Health Bloomington. Positive Link, which has been operating in Monroe County since 1991, opened the door to its health clinic last week. Jill Stowers is the clinical lead manager of community health at IU Health Bloomington Hospital and runs Positive Link. She says the opening of the clinic on Miller Drive near the IU Bloomington Hospital is a big step forward to providing care for HIV positive and HIV negative populations in the area.
So Positive Link has actually been around since 91, and we have been providing kind of the wraparound support services around HIV care without providing the medical services. So we do a lot of education and testing out in the community. We work and do care coordination for folks who are infected with HIV, work with their families, help with just some of the social determinants of health. And one of the things that we've really has kind of arisen as a gap in our community is that access to primary care. We have an amazing specialist in our community, which is something I'm just really, really grateful for, Dr. Tom Hurst-Mollis. But a lot of our folks weren't seeing primary care. And as HIV has become more of a chronic disease and something that we can treat and we can address, you know, our folks need to be seeing primary care as well.
Stower said Positive Link partnered with the Indiana State Department of Health and the Health Foundation for Greater Indianapolis to start the Bloomington Clinic. She says Positive Link fills the gap in primary care that's existed in South Central Indiana for decades.
People who are HIV positive can come in and get their primary care. And then people who are HIV negative but may have risk for HIV infection can come in and see our nurse practitioner about pre-exposure prophylaxis. So those are really the two primary services that we offer through the clinic.
The new clinic also works with clients to provide what's called wraparound services. Stowers says the clinic provides wraparound services to clients. Those are needs that can impact patients' health care needs.
You know, we provide a lot of housing. The vast majority of our clients are living, you know, either at the poverty line or maybe just above it. And so if we're able to keep them stably housed, then that is going to have a huge impact on their health outcomes. And so we really look at that as a component of health care. So we run nutrition programs, and we partner with both the Hoosier Hills Food Bank and with Community Kitchen to make sure that our folks have nutritious meals. We're just starting now a partnership with the medical nutrition therapists at the hospital to do more education and one-on-one work with some of our clients around the impact of nutrition on overall health. Will help pay, you know, for school supplies, because for some of our folks that have kids, they may be looking at, you know, I've got $50 that I need to spend on school supplies, and I've got $50 that I need to pay a medication copay. And my kid needs to have school supplies when they go to school. And so, you know, we'll either pay the medication copay or we'll pay for the school supplies so that we're removing those barriers to the health outcomes that we want to see.
Stoer says HIV is nothing new to this area of Indiana, and the opioid epidemic hasn't changed rates of infection. She says Bloomington has often been the only option for the people of southern Indiana to access HIV care.
If you go back to the 80s, before there was really much that people could do, there were a lot of hospitals out there that did not accept HIV patients, which is somewhat unfathomable today to think of, but that was the reality. And Bloomington Hospital, at the time Bloomington Hospital, now IU Health Bloomington, was one of the very few hospitals in the entire southern half of the state that would accept HIV patients. So, you know, regionally, that's where people would come. And so the hospital partnered very closely with the Community AIDS Action Group. And then once funding became available through the Ryan White Care Act in 91, Positive Link was formed. And so then we've been part of that effort since that time. So there is certainly, you know, the HIV outbreak and the rise in opioids is changing somewhat of the mix of who's at risk and of who's becoming infected in the state and in the South Central region. We have more people who have become infected through needle usage now than we had, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But that infection rate has pretty much remained stable over the entire course of HIV's history.
Stoer says treatment has evolved since the 1980s, and she sees preventative and primary care services like those offered by Positive Link as the next evolution in treating the disease.
When you look at the history of the disease, you have kind of HIV in the 80s and early 90s when there wasn't medication. And in 1996, that changed. That was when we first got medications that worked. And so you can look at the course of the disease and say there was before meds and there was after meds. And we're in a similar shift now in that because the infection rate has not decreased ever, we haven't been able to do that. So you can make people healthier, you can keep them alive longer, but we haven't been able to decrease the infection rate. Now, with the effectiveness of the medications and the ability to do a suppressed viral load, combining that with PrEP, we can start to see another shift that could very potentially be as big in the course of this disease as getting effective medications was in 96, because now we do have the ability to address the infection rate, and that's really where we're going to be able to stop the spread of HIV.
Positive Link opened its doors on December 5th. The clinic is located at 333 East Miller Drive here in Bloomington.
The Indiana State Health Department recorded the first flu death in the state last week. The victim was under the age of 18. ISDH is cautioning Indiana residents to take precautions during flu season, which lasts from October until May. Sally Halliburton is an ISDH respiratory epidemiologist.
Last year, we had two reported pediatric flu deaths during the season. So it's not unusual. I mean, it's more common in an older population, but there's just different, anybody can die of the flu, of complications.
Halliburton says it's not the flu that kills people, it's complications resulting from the infection.
So although anyone can get the flu, there's people that are at higher risk for complications, such as pneumonia. That's a pretty common one. And then high-risk individuals include pregnant women, young children, especially those that are too young to get vaccinated. So anyone under the age of 6 months cannot get the flu vaccine. If you have a chronic illness or you're immunocompromised, and then people that are over the age of 65 as well.
Halliburton stated that the ISDH has recorded peak numbers of influenza cases throughout flu season. Last year, the sickness infected the highest number of people in December, but she's seen it peak as late as March. She states that the state recommends that those at risk get a flu shot this season.
Just getting your flu shot, it's recommended for anyone over the age of 6 months to get vaccinated. And then following the three C's, which is wash, clean, cover, and contain. So washing your hands frequently, covering your cough and sneezes, and staying home from school or work when you are sick, or just avoiding others who are sick.
Common signs and symptoms of the flu include a fever of 100 degrees Fahrenheit or greater, headaches, fatigue, cough, muscle aches, a sore throat, and a runny or stuffy nose.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is promising to increase the efficiency of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP benefits program. In a press release, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue says, quote, SNAP was created to provide people with the help they need to feed themselves and their families, but it was not intended to be a permanent lifestyle, end quote. He aims at transitioning people from the government program back into work. The USDA is trying to make improvements to promote local control over SNAP. Mother Hubbard's Cupboard's Director of Education and Outreach, Stephanie Solomon, disagrees with the changes. She says making it harder to access food stamps would have a negative impact on the community. Solomon believes that the statements indicate that it will become harder for families to obtain SNAP benefits.
At Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, we are passionate about everybody having as much access to the food that their household needs. And it's a little hard to understand the USDA's statement, but what it sounds like is that there could be increased barriers to food stamps or SNAP benefits. And that is always a negative thing for people experiencing food insecurity.
SNAP has many requirements that families must meet in order to be put on the program. This includes a low income. A family of five must make under $3,000 a month. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, of Indiana SNAP users, 31% are families with members who are elderly or have disabilities. 1 in 9 Indiana residents require SNAP. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities of Indiana SNAP users, more than 73% of participants are families with children. 47% are working families. Solomon says the so-called push for efficiency in the program could create more hurdles for Indiana families.
It sounds like there will be the possibility of things like increased work requirements for adults with dependents. I mean, we already saw work requirements for adults without dependents, and work requirements often are just one more barrier to people getting the food stamps that they need. And so, as far as I can understand, this would be a bigger burden on families that are already struggling to put food on the table.
In 2012, SNAPs made up 2% of overall government spending compared to 19% on national defense. Now, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, SNAP program was responsible for helping Indiana's economy with $1.1 billion back in 2016. For every dollar used in the program, it generates around $1.70 in economic growth. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, between 2009 and 2012, the Indiana SNAP program kept 224,000 people out of poverty. Half of those individuals were children.
Support for WFHB comes from Cardinal Spirits Distillery, located on the B-line. Cardinal Spirits has opened a new kitchen featuring local seasonal food made from scratch to complement their craft cocktails. Dinner is available Tuesday through Saturday at Cardinal Spirits, 922 South Morton Street. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Barbara Fuqua.
And I'm Scott Weddle. The Indiana Recovery Alliance engages in harm reduction and syringe support services throughout southern Indiana. On Monday, Monroe County Commissioners reapproved the IRA's efforts.
Chris Abert, you're the founder and director of the Indiana Recovery Alliance. It's my understanding that the Indiana Recovery Alliance's needle exchange program was just renewed by county commissioners on Monday. What do you feel about the needle exchange program being renewed in Monroe County?
Sure. So, yeah, the syringe service program of the services that we offer was reapproved by the county commissioners for the next 2 years. So it's a huge relief. in that we don't have to worry existentially about whether or not we're going to be able to continue. But B, we can also focus on these other services that we're offering. I think a lot of people don't understand that the syringe services aspect of what we do is actually a very small but important part of the overall services. So we're really excited to be able to continue those services, but also be able to expand in other areas where, we're trying to combat the negative effects of the opioid epidemic.
There's a naloxone training at the Monroe County Public Library on Saturday. Can you tell us a little bit more about that training? What exactly goes on during a naloxone training? And for some of our listeners who aren't aware, could you explain what naloxone is?
Sure. Naloxone is an opiate overdose reversal medication. It's very simple and safe to use. It only has one use, and that it reverses overdoses. So it can't be abused. It's very, very safe. So we have trainings. Anybody, any community member can come into outreach hours at any time and get naloxone and get the training on how to administer it. And then 5 or 6 times a year, we'll do a more comprehensive training. And that's about 2.5 hours for this comprehensive training. And it includes the ability at the end to be able to distribute naloxone yourself if you complete the training successfully. So rather than just being, like a 10-minute training on how to use it, it's a 2.5-hour training about, what naloxone is, how it works physiologically, what are the laws that surround it, what are signs of overdoses, very, very in-depth instruction on naloxone. And the good thing is if you are part of an organization, rather than continuously having to send people to the Indiana Recovery Alliance to get trained, you yourself can then do that training with your employees. You can do that training with family members who might be using drugs, and friends can share the information and the actual medication with each other. We were very limited funding-wise and limited staff-wise on how much reach we have. But with getting all these other community members trained, we can expand that reach greatly. That we've trained hundreds and hundreds of people in this more comprehensive training. So we're excited to continue to offer that as a service to the community.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the reauthorization process? Is this something that the Indiana Recovery Alliance has to apply for? Or is this something that commissioners have kind of requested from the Indiana Recovery Alliance?
Yeah, so this is mandated from the state level that every 2 years the commissioners, basically what happens is there is a health emergency declared by the local health department, and then the commissioners approve that. So in Monroe County, we have a hepatitis C emergency, a state of emergency for hepatitis C. And then the next part of that is, as with any other contract for the county, the commissioners are asked to sign a contract for the Indiana Recovery Alliance to actually do that work to combat the spread of hepatitis C specifically, but also to ensure that, a Scott County-type HIV outbreak doesn't occur in our county, to help people who would like other services to receive those services, whether that's food, housing, insurance, treatment. So there's a whole plethora of services that come along with that, but it's based around hepatitis C rates in Monroe County.
And when you say there's a hepatitis C emergency, what exactly does that look like, or how is that quantified, I guess?
Yeah, so there's no... That's going to be up to each individual municipality what they consider a hepatitis C emergency. So just to give some rough numbers, I believe it was somewhere around in the last 5 years, 200, something like that, new hepatitis C cases. Now, if we just quickly do the math on treatment for those cases at about $90,000 to $100,000, it quickly adds up to tens of millions of dollars. And we're just one county in a state that's being hit with this these rising hepatitis C rates. I think a lot of listeners probably aren't aware that hepatitis C is the number one infectious disease in the country. There are more people with hepatitis C than the next top 10 infectious diseases combined, which are not tuberculosis and HIV, all these more commonly known infectious diseases. One of the reasons that a lot of people aren't aware of this is because the population that suffers the most has historically been marginalized populations, Latino, African American communities, IV drug users specifically. Right now, the fastest growing population of hepatitis C infection is in white rural and urban communities. Suburban communities. So suddenly, it's coming into the limelight more, I guess, for lack of a better word. And what's interesting is the fastest increase in injection drugs is also among that same population. So, you know, it's a sad story that when it was happening to marginalized communities, there wasn't a lot of effort to address it. And now that it's happening to a different community, right, the white rural and suburban community, suddenly resources to some extent are being rallied to meet the need. So our hope is that as we move forward and as we make progress, that we don't leave those marginalized communities behind again.
And Chris, the needle exchange program being renewed in Monroe County, that allows you to continue your work in Monroe County. We've seen a shift from the state of emergency being declared, where several different counties had opened up needle exchange programs and what you call harm reduction programs. But it seems like recently there's been kind of a backlash, both in the local political spectrum, and then also with Attorney General Curtis Hill has repeatedly criticized needle exchange programs. And he's also had that criticism echoed by state prosecuting attorneys associations. Can you talk a little bit about kind of that ongoing battle between offering harm reduction programs and the political backlash that the Indiana Recovery Alliance, among other needle exchange programs and harm reduction programs, end up facing in the state?
Sure. I definitely don't want to overstate the case, though. I want to make it really clear that Attorney General Curtis Hill is alienated and he is an outlier within his own party. So his views and the views of his office and fellow prosecutors are an anomaly within our political picture today. So I hope that listeners, again, understand that while it's more like two steps forward, a half a step backwards than any like turning of the tide, the general consensus, not only throughout Indiana, but through other states with similar political environments, North Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, is to move forward and in West Virginia and to treat this as a public health issue and not a criminal justice issue. Unfortunately, we have remnants within the criminal justice system who refuse to let go, as evidenced by Attorney General Curtis Hill and some of the prosecutors throughout the state, not all. And I think it's really important to remember, too, that overall, we're talking about really one syringe service program that got shut down. That was in Lawrence County. Because I think something that's not reported is Madison County was also, quote-unquote, shut down. But all of the people who were against that have since recanted, and that is set to reopen with a private community-based organization administering the program, Aspire Health Systems, I believe. So again, there was there have been these like slight setbacks, but the overall momentum is a move towards public health response to this, a move away from criminal justice. And of course, we expect kind of like the dinosaurs that are really stuck in this, people that are trying to advance their political careers and they can take advantage of vulnerable populations and throw them under the bus to advance themselves. You know, we completely expect that. Looking historically, at politicians who get tough on quote unquote crime as a vehicle for, you know, their other platforms. We're not surprised about the prosecutors. We're not surprised about Curtisville. And honestly, I'm not surprised about Lawrence County. Overall, the move is forward. And I honestly believe that we're on the right side of history.
Chris Abert with the Indiana Recovery Alliance. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, Wes, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
As the year comes to a close, everybody is celebrating one holiday or another, and most of us are still shopping for things to give our family and friends. Depending on who you ask, the average American will spend between $967 and $1,189 on gifts this year, up more than 15% over last year. Real quick, here's half a dozen ways to keep your generosity from giving good cheer to the wrong people. Scammers and swindlers. Gift cards are really popular, but selling them if you don't use them or buying them from third parties can be really dangerous. There are a few reputable companies that offer guarantees on gift cards, but the safest way to buy is to buy them only from the store where they're good and pass them on to a real person. Gift cards from local stores and restaurants are by far the safest ones. Online websites selling brand-name things at amazing discounts are probably offering counterfeit merchandise. And the grifters aren't just faking Rolex watches these days. They're pushing knockoff toys and games and everything else. Ever hear the saying, you get what you pay for? Electronic holiday cards have been faked to a fare-thee-well by fraudsters. They can look exactly like they came through a genuine e-card company and still be a trap, fishing for your personal information or waiting to stuff a virus into your electronic stocking. If you get an e-card, check with the supposed sender before you open it. And if you send cards, use the post office. Coupons can save you money or steal it. There are legitimate coupons and promo codes to use while shopping, but if you get them online, you should never have to give any personal information. Even giving your cell phone number to get a coupon can bring you scads of marketing calls. Ordering things online to pick them up in the store is convenient and risky. Crooks are using stolen ID information to glom everything in stock before you can. So before you go this route, check out the store's policies and call your local store to make sure they'll have your gift when you get there. And as the deadlines get nearer, all too many online retail websites will promise that whatever you order is in stock and will be delivered in time. And all too often, it just ain't so, especially if the product is coming from another country. Order early, order from domestic companies, don't send a check, and never wire money. Pay with a credit card or a reputable service like PayPal. Now, if there's anyone listening who believes in Santa Claus, please turn down the radio for a moment. For the rest of us, when we finally found out the truth about old Saint Nick, it was our very first lesson in the best advice of all. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Alex Davis and Wes Martin. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Our engineer today is Dan Withard. Our theme music provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Barbara Fuqua. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program, recognized among the best newscasts in 2016 by the Indiana chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. And stay tuned for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.